Okay, I want to say up front, if you have little ears in the room because so many kids are home, you might want to grab your earbuds or headphones for this segment or check it out later on demand because we're going to be discussing entertainment that is, well, adult. Growing up, kids don't often have a full story about their parents. In the case of a California family, the Mason family, there was a lot that the three kids didn't know about mom and dad. For starters, the couple did own a bookstore in West Hollywood. What the kids didn't know is that the store sold, in the words of Mr. and Mrs. Mason, gay porn and lots of it. Their store was one of the best known in the state. Rachel Mason tells the story of her parents and the store they owned in her new documentary Circus of Books, which is streaming now on Netflix. The film is also the story of gay culture through the 80s and 90s, the political fight around adult entertainment, the advent of the AIDS epidemic, and the importance of community. IndieWire declared that it's the best LGBTQ documentary of the year. Rachel, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So when you and your brothers were little kids, what did your parents, Karen and Barry, tell you about their stores?
Well, they didn't tell us very much. And, you know, we were actually raised in a pretty strict way. I wasn't actually allowed to watch much television or eat much candy. And so when we would go into the store, the first thing we would notice is this giant wall of candy. And that's actually all we really cared about at that moment, being kids. And then, of course, there was an over 18 section, which we couldn't go into. And I just assumed every store had an over 18 section.
How old were you when you realized what kind of store it was?
Well, I think I was about 15 or so because I was in high school, and that's kind of where I came into my own as a person, as an artist, as somebody who gravitated towards the punk kids, the goth kids, the queer kids that I, you know, completely fell in love with. And my friends in LA, I went to high school in the Valley, they would make a special trip to go to Circus of Books. And when I told my friends that my parents owned the place, they were like, well, that's a gay porn store, Rachel. And it was actually so cool to my friends. But, you know, my parents were the opposite of cool. I had friends who had cool parents, and mine were not those. They were square. They were practically like straight out of the 1950s. And so that didn't jive with just the reality of who my parents were. But when I would go to the store and see the kind of amazing wild culture there, I totally fell in love with it.
Let's get a little background on your parents, because you have that experience that a lot of us have as we get older and we suddenly look at our parents as people, not just as mom and dad. So part of the film is an exploration of their lives. And you found out your mother had been a reporter, and she covered pretty edgy stories at the time. Can you describe her early professional life?
Right. Well, this is what, you know, the process of discovery opened up for me when I made the documentary. She always had this trunk in the basement that I never really looked at. It was filled with her articles. And, you know, when I really decided in earnest to make the documentary, I opened up the trunk. And lo and behold, I found all of these articles that she was covering. She was a beat reporter in Cincinnati. And then, you know, while she was there, there were a lot of smut raids. And interestingly enough, Larry Flint, who would go on to become very instrumental in my parents' actual porn career, he started out in Cincinnati himself. And my mom interviewed him for an article when he was starting out as a young man. And then she also wrote about smut raids. She interviewed the Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, who said famously, you know, I know it when I see it in regard to obscenity. So there was just this amazing kind of uncanny parallel to the story she was covering at the time. But of course, this was part of just the general day to day of being a beat reporter covering murders, crime stories, and all the other things that one does on the local beat.
And we learn about your father that he started out in motion picture special effects. He worked on 2001 Space Odyssey, Star Trek. He invented an incredible medical device. Obviously, a really smart man, a really lovely man you get from the film. How did they make the jump from what they were doing in their respective careers to opening the store?
Well, you know, I think that's what makes this a really unlikely story, but also the funny twist of it all is that my dad was hoping to basically get his dialysis machines patented and into circulation. But, you know, malpractice insurance became this enormous thing in the early 80s, late 70s, and they couldn't possibly afford it. And yet my dad's dad, my grandfather, was on dialysis, and my dad had absolutely no training in medical devices, but he's sort of a tinkerer. And, you know, you get a picture of the kind of people operating in the late 70s in all kinds of fields. Now that I, you know, really did my due diligence in looking at it, you know, the people that were even in the motion picture industry, they were all kind of mavericks. And so my dad took his motion picture special effects technology skills and kind of applied them to something he didn't know about. But, you know, you can, as an engineer, you can kind of do certain basic things, and he figured out a way to emit light through a tube in the same way that you emit light through a special effects machine to do the three-part projection that you needed to capture what now with a green screen everyone does on their computer. It was actually a huge long process in the early days of special effects. But all these technologies kind of interwove. And, you know, I also think I realized that just the ingenuity of people who are involved as inventors in the world, and that was what my dad was hoping to do, was he was going to just create this auxiliary to a dialysis machine. And to this day, that actual appliance is in almost every machine. It's called the foam detector, and it saved many lives, but he never was able to really monetize it properly. So this was kind of a sideline that they could do while they were trying to figure it out. And that was, you know, delivering magazines, Hustler. As it turned out, they were Larry Flint's first distributors of Hustler in LA. And then Hustler also happened to Larry Flint took on a few gay publications, which, you know, could seem like a small thing by today's standards. Like, okay, well, you know, why not take on some gay publications? But at the time in the late 70s, that was a pretty amazing thing. You know, it was still a totally fringe part of our society, if fringe being the best possible word for it. You know, gay people were truly outcasts and shunned. And so just having the wherewithal and the, I would say, kind of the amazing forethought, which is Larry Flint, and also my parents, to just say, hey, we can distribute this stuff. There's no problem. There's a market for it. It doesn't matter that it's gay. You know, that was a pretty incredible thing, because at that time, it was not an allowable way to be. Being gay was actually considered pretty reprehensible to society. And that's what I tried to show in the film moving forward, is that my interviews with elders in the gay community just have such painful experiences that when they looked at erotic content, it wasn't like, you know, porn in the sense of, you know, people often just sort of like roll their eyes in some ways, but porn was actually a lifeline. It was this image to many gay people of something that was totally taboo. And being gay was thought of in line with, you know, pedophilia or incest, things that by today's standards we consider totally, you know, not part of our culture. And that was what was amazing about the early people involved in gay adult material.
My guest is Rachel Mason. We're talking about her new documentary, Circus of Books, about her parents' bookstore, Circus of Books, that was in L.A. It has since closed. I believe it was last year that it closed. It's interesting in the documentary because your mom talks about in the early days that it was sort of a means to an end. Like they needed to make money. It was going to be a bridge in terms of it, to whatever they were going to do next. When did it become for them, no, this is what we're going to do?
Well, you know, my mom always seemed to find a way to compartmentalize and downplay, you know, that this was actually what she was most involved in. So I think there was a moment, however, my dad said this recently to me, that when he stopped depositing his checks for the dialysis payments, that's when they realized, you know, he realized that this was just their main source of income, because the dialysis payments paled in comparison to what they were making at the store.
It's in, you know, you mentioned on this that the people who were in the film that you interviewed said, you know, it's so different. You don't understand about how important this place was, that it was really a community center in many ways. And a lot of the employees that you interview are incredibly, incredibly loyal. What was its role in the gay community during that time?
Well, you know, during the 80s and 90s, it was basically, you know, it's almost an uncanny thing that this film is coming out at a time of a mass epidemic that the entire world is feeling the actual, like, horror of, because that's what the gay community was feeling in the 80s and 90s. I mean, really, it was just an epidemic, but the difference was nobody cared in the mainstream. The government didn't care. And so imagine having an epidemic wiping out all of your friends, but nobody is actually stepping up to do anything. And so that's why you had these heroic organizations and people with ACT UP being really like the only voice for saying, we need to help. This is actually an epidemic. It's a crisis. People are dying. We need to figure this out. And then you had people like my parents, and this is what I show in the film, but I really basically hope that we acknowledge all the people like my parents everywhere in cities, in many other places that maybe didn't get the opportunity to have their kid make a documentary about them. People like my parents just were bearing witness to something that was a nightmare. And instead of saying, wow, okay, God is certainly condemning these people because they chose to live in sin, as many in our government were saying at the time, my parents simply said, you know, wow, this kid who's been a great employee, he's, you know, somebody that has a wonderful personality, is dying in a horrible way. We should really help him. And they went to visit many of their employees in the hospices. And these were people really dying similarly, isolated and scary deaths in hospitals. You know, that's why I say it's an uncanny parallel right now with COVID, because the AIDS crisis was just so terrifying at the early stages. And I have to look back at what my parents did at that moment and see in myself a kind of, I'm amazed that they had the wherewithal to visit people at a time when people were not visiting these young men. And I remember as a kid thinking these guys were so cool. They were young. They were in their 20s. And they were, you know, you see Alaska Thunder, well, I can't say the last name, but Alaska, who's RuPaul's Drag Race star, it was one of the clerks, and he has just got the best personality. And, you know, there were people just like Alaska who were my parents' clerks the entire time. And as a kid, I remember how funny and wonderful they were. And then they would be dead. And so I recalled only later in life thinking, wow, that's actually insane that so many of these people died. And I kind of got to know them and thought they were fabulous and wonderful, and my own introduction to gay culture through the store. But a generation was wiped out. And I think that's what we have not really properly mourned in our culture. And I think, you know, the gay population is very much all of us. We are all connected. You know, there's not a single person I know that hasn't been touched in some way by the AIDS crisis. And yet we really haven't mourned and properly dealt with that loss, I think. So I really wanted to make this film in a really big way to mourn this population and to think about those people, especially within the sex industry, and, you know, not look at it as this sort of shadowy, dark industry, but actually as a healing art. You know, I actually look at porn in that way. We are human beings with sexual interests, and to pretend like we are not engaged in sexual activity is really kind of absurd. And especially within a community that is so humiliated by our culture at that time, I think what those people were doing were really incredibly brave. And I look at gay porn as a kind of activism to this
day. There's this moment in the film where your dad describes calling the parents of an employee who was dying. And I do want to play that clip.
We would call the parents and say, hey, your son is sick. You know, don't you want to come? And a lot of them would just say, nope, I don't. I like kicked him out. I never want to see the guy again. I said, but he's your son. I was just so surprised that the parents could be so bad to their children. And I didn't think about the gay part of it. It was just their children.
That is a clip from Circus of Books, now streaming on Netflix. I'm talking to its director, Rachel Mason. It's a documentary about her parents and about their bookstore, Circus of Books, and what it meant in terms of gay culture and culture, period. So I want to point out, though, to people that this is not sort of a hagiography of your parents, and you go deep into some issues in the family. Your mother is extremely religious, and, you know, she had a hard time at one point in her life reconciling what she did, what was going on with her family, and the gay and gay community. How did she work through that? Ultimately, we learn, I don't think it's a surprise, we learn that she does work through it. But, you know, it borders on homophobia at one point.
Well, I think it absolutely was internalized homophobia that my mom addresses as being just very deep within her because of her religious beliefs. And what I think is amazing about her ability to address it in such a forthright way is it's because she became an activist. And I think the best kind of activists for the LGBT community are people like my mom, because when you see a person who somehow, I mean, really, separated out from the fact that she happened to run a gay porn store, she actually was just a very religious woman with extremely traditional values, even just gender values that I fought against as a young girl. My mom would insist that I would wear, you know, dresses to any sort of family function and anything that was religious, and it drove me crazy because I just thought it was really obnoxious. And I myself rebelled against all of these religious views. But my mom was so, had these very antiquated biblical beliefs, including the one about homosexuality that, you know, is the same one that the right wing used to condemn her own business. So I think she managed to compartmentalize a belief system that you see play out when my brother came out. And I think, you know, part of the issue with my little brother is that he was the most perfect, wonderful gay child. And this often is thought of in some ways as like gay perfectionism. You know, he was like the Pete Buttigieg. He was a totally, absolutely perfect kid. And I think being a boy, being a male who is saying that he's gay right after she's witnessed the entire AIDS epidemic in front of her eyes, it all sort of conspired to create a big pile of very painful feelings. And, you know, I would say truly she addresses it head on in a way that's really remarkable in the film. And what happens that you see her go through a kind of process of figuring out that she knew that she had to get over this, because what she saw other kids do, you know, other parents do to their kids was so wrong, as you hear with my dad. And I do have to say, my mom and my dad are completely on opposite sides like this. My dad mm-hmm. is the one who is totally comfortable and really had a very different and much more gracious reaction to my brother coming out. But, you know, there's that's what I wanted to point out in the film, because I think that we see in many families this kind of painful processing that parents have when they're religious, and clearly they love their kids, but they can't reconcile something with their religion. And, you know, I think that it really was an incredible gift that my mom managed to get through this and then be so forthcoming in the film, because the reaction that I've gotten all over the world now is that she's been, you know, her reaction is similar to many people's, and not everybody's parents came out on the other side. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm very grateful that she can be that teacher and she can educate. And she's a big advocate for PFLAG, parents and friends of LGBT people. And it's an amazing organization that if anyone is struggling as a parent or even as a child with parents that are difficult, having difficulty, PFLAG is an amazing advocacy organization. That's the work they do. And that's what helped my mom get through it.
The name of the film is Circus of Books. It is by Rachel Mason. There's so much more to this film, including, Rachel, I have to say, I just love the back and forth between you and your mom, where your mom's like, why is this interesting? Why is this a movie? It's some of the greatest family dynamics ever. Rachel, congratulations on the film. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on the show.